is made possible in part by 10,000 Villages. 10,000 Villages' 13th annual showcase of Fair Trade Oriental rugs will be held March 9th through the 12th at their store, 105 North Walnut in downtown Champaign. On Tuesday, March 10th at 7 p.m., an informal seminar about Oriental rugs will be held at the store. For more information, call 352-8200. Support for today's broadcast is provided by World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign. For over 15 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with an international selection of cheeses, olive oil, balsamic vinegar, spices, chocolates, cookies, and more. Catering services are also available. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL, Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. Do you ever wonder about what might have been? Who doesn't? Our topic this afternoon is regret, and our guest is Neil Rose. He's an associate professor of psychology at the University of Illinois. His area of particular interest in the field is counterfactual thinking and regret. Professor Rose says in the language of psychology, regrets are the emotional offspring of counterfactuals. More about counterfactuals and counterfactual thinking coming up in just a minute or two. And believe me, it's very interesting. You'll want to stay tuned. Otherwise, you might regret not continuing to listen. Our guest this afternoon, Neil Rose, is the author of a book about regret for lay readers that looks at the science of regret and offers practical advice for using regret to move forward. The book's title, If Only, How to Turn Regret into Opportunity. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for Neil Rose. Join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our number anywhere else, use the toll-free number if it would be a long-distance call, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Professor Rose's book, If Only, How to Turn Regret into Opportunity, is published by Broadway Books. Professor Rose, thanks for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you.
And I regret not having proofread what I had written in my introduction here this afternoon before launching into it. I mentioned in my introduction that your book can help us use regret to move forward. But as you note at the outset of If Only, we may see regret as something to avoid or to shed as soon as possible. And you point out that for years, psychologists agreed that was the best thing to do, to get over it and move on. Why the change in thinking?
Part of that reflects a change in conception and what we see as the value of negative emotions in general. And you might think, overall, our emotions are things that get in the way of rational thinking, of effective problem solving, but it turns out to be not the case. Our emotions are extremely important for guiding decision making, and feeling bad is a useful signal that things need to be fixed, that corrective action needs to be taken. And regret is a really good example of that. Regret is a signal from your brain that there is some thing that you could have done differently, and perhaps there is opportunity open for you to fix things and change things for the better in the future. And what our most recent research is telling us is that as part of an exquisitely designed system that keeps our emotions in balance, for most people, most of the time, regrets that don't serve any useful purpose are swept away automatically by the brain without our realizing it. So those regrets that do persist the longest are reflections of areas in life where we still have the opportunity to fix things.
So we can reflect on what has happened and grow from that or change our course of action.
That's right. And there is an important reminder here, which is that it is possible to have too much regret. It's possible to be enveloped in ruminations and repetitive thought that kicks yourself over and over again. That that is bad, and that could be the precursor to depression. And certainly people can wallow in their misery and not actually do anything. But for most people, most of the time, there's an ideal middle ground. Not too much regret, not too little regret either. A middle ground in which you listen to the insights that your brain is providing you about your past behaviors.
Yeah. The emotional offspring of counterfactual thinking. What is counterfactual thinking?
Well, I'm glad you asked that. One of the reasons I wrote the book was to popularize a word that is enormously useful. The idea of counterfactual thinking is it is thinking about how the past might have been different. Anytime you think about what if or if only, you imagine how past actions could have been taken differently, you're engaging in counterfactual thinking. It's an idea that psychologists have been working with, as well as philosophers and as well as historians. And so I think it's rather effortless for us to think about, let's say, what if I had had tea instead of coffee? What if I had married somebody else? What if I had attended a different school? Or you can even look at it on a much larger perspective and think about history. You could think, what if President Kennedy hadn't been shot? What would the 60s have been like? What if the Germans had won the Second World War? Well, these are questions that are enormously fascinating, both to the average person as well as to historians and philosophers, and a lot of academic work is focused on the importance of these counterfactual insights. And so I wanted to talk about all the different ways that different scholars have used the term counterfactual, although I have emphasized the psychological nature.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to think about how you cannot have drama without counterfactuals.
Yeah, I thought that was an interesting connection as well. The key insight is that counterfactual thoughts influence our emotions, and they do this by drawing points of contrast between reality, which is what is, what we know around us, and alternatives. So we can think about how the past might have been better. Okay, for me personally, I might have become a dentist, in which case I would be having more fun in my daily life. That's a joke. And if I think about how things might have been better, it might make my current circumstances feel a little less satisfying, a little bit more pallid. By contrast, I could also think about how the past might have been worse. And certainly when we think about what would have happened if the Germans had won the Second World War, that's an example of a downward counterfactual, something that's worse than current reality. And that may make us feel more gratified, more satisfied. We might appreciate things a bit more. Now, in drama, a writer, a novelist, a filmmaker can strategically place counterfactual thoughts or suggestions of alternatives so as to push our emotions around. So a hero who very nearly falls into a pit of snakes, the snakes might be shown or might be merely suggested, but a close call that nearly happened makes us feel perhaps a momentary surge of excitement or fear, and then a release as we realize this negative thing didn't happen. At the same time, a story can be more poignant or more heart-rending if we see that some great alternative was barely missed, some lost love nearly could have been but wasn't.
Yeah. One of the films that you mentioned a number of times in the book, if only, is On the Waterfront. And that wonderful line, you know, I could have been a contender, that sums up
yes.
what the character has come to see, what has happened to him, and is reexamining his life. Talk with us about that character and in terms of the counterfactual.
Yes. Well, in the film On the Waterfront, a story about union and mob politics in the 1950s, Marlon Brando's character is a former boxer. He thinks about the fact that he might have been a contender, might have been a champion, might have been a winner at his chosen sport, but he deliberately threw a fight because of mob pressure. And so he thinks about this as a personal failing, and he thinks about what might have been. He could have been a contender instead of a bum, which is what I am, is the famous quote. And it is an example of a life-altering counterfactual, a turning point, a fork in the road, which defines the very essence of life. Many of us have these kinds of forks in the road that we focus on. Some of us feel that it is deeply definitive of our life. Other people think it's not so much of a big deal. in this case of the Marlon Brando character, it was not only life-defining, but an incentive for ongoing change, for ongoing improvement. So in other words, he decides to make a stand. He decides to live a life of greater honesty based on this earlier counterfactual. And I think this is emblematic of the positive side of regret, which is that you can take self-blame or feelings of what you should have done differently in the past and channel them into ongoing action, into different kinds of improvements in your life. And I think overall what research has been telling us is that counterfactual thinking is largely a tool for betterment. It's largely part of a system of learning from experience and automatically correcting for past mistakes. We don't see it happening most of the time. What we do see is kicking ourselves, and it feels bad, but underneath it is an exquisite mechanism that helps us to improve and do fairly well in life.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. It's tied up, his statement, I could have been a contender, is tied up with guilt and shame.
Yes.
And then he is able to, by examining what has happened to him, he's redeemed in the end.
Yes, I think that's exactly right.
Yeah.
And I tell several other stories similar to that in the book.
Yeah. Well, where would Hamlet have been without his, to be or not to be?
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Well, that's another interesting aspect of this story, which is choice is an essential component of our lives, to be or not to be. Well, that's a very big choice. But we make choices daily. We think about the foods that we eat and the people we interact with. We think about where to live, what to do with ourselves. Any choice that we make contains the seeds for counterfactuals. I mean, anytime you make a decision, it means you have foregone some alternative. That alternative might come back to haunt you. It might come back to bite you. And I spend a whole chapter talking about consumer decision-making, how you buy, how to become more satisfied with what you buy, how to perhaps use the natural counterfactual thoughts that pop out of your brain in a more effective manner. And one of the interesting things that's come out of recent research is just an emphasis on how dissatisfied a lot of Americans are. And one of the things that this stems from is the sheer amount of choice. We all seem to think that more choice is better. 64 flavors of ice cream is better than 32 flavors, which is better than 16 flavors. But is that really the case?
Yeah.
Some recent laboratory research suggests that there's a threshold we can reach where more choice spells greater dissatisfaction. And part of that comes from just the regret of, gee, did I make the right choice? Did I sample everything out there? Is it the right car? Is it the right set of clothing? Is it the right perfect experience for me? And so it's good to keep in mind that more choice is not always better. But another interesting aspect somewhat related to this is that we all appreciate the fact that we can return goods that we buy to a store. We like a return policy so that we can give things back if we change our minds later. It turns out that the mere act of being able to return things makes us a little bit less satisfied because we keep thinking, gee, could I have done better? Could I have done better? Is it still possible for me to do better? If we buy something and we're totally stuck with it, we're in no way able to return it, we turn out to be more satisfied with it because natural mechanisms of rationalization take over and make us feel better without our realizing it.
Yeah. Reminds me of Bob's pretty good grocery in Lake Wobegon.
Mm-hmm.
If they don't have it, you probably don't need it.
That's very good.
That's psychologist very wise. Neil Rose is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with him today about regret. He's the author of If Only, How to Turn Regret into Opportunity. This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with your questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and 800-222-WILL. Well, a listener is joining us this afternoon on line one, and as soon as we get that caller in the system here. We'll talk with our listener on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I have a comment and two questions.
Okay.
Well, one, the comment is, in the hospice, I used to tell people the two most fatal words were if only. That is reread. I'm very grateful for your guest, by the way. And the question that I have to ask is counterfactual the same as counter... I don't know what I'm trying to say, but I used to say this counter in hospice. Have your guests compare counterfactual. I understand the concept, but counterproductive is the word I'm looking for.
Oh, counterproductive.
Yes.
Okay.
And I'll hang up and listen off the air.
Okay. Hospice. In a hospice situation, those words, if only.
Yes. Well, the words if only are the deepest conveyance of counterfactual thinking, and they suggest that there was a way that things could have been different and a way that you could have accomplished something differently in the past. That could be either a blame or recrimination, or it could be a bit of appreciation for something that was well done. Counterproductive compared to counterfactual. Well, counterproductive means that you're doing something that is not going to produce a desired outcome. And a lot of counterfactual thoughts are about how you could have achieved a more ideal situation. So in other words, most of our counterfactual thoughts are aimed specifically at how we could have achieved goals that are meaningful to us. Now, if you have the chance to fix things, these are very useful. So listen to what they say and put them into action. But if it's a done deal, if the game is over, if there's nothing more that you could do, that's the ideal time to just let it rest and not focus on if only anymore.
Yeah.
That is the essence of true wisdom, is knowing when to do that, right? That's something
yeah.
that we're all taught from a very young age. It's a part of a lot of people's religious upbringing.
Yeah. Well, it reminds me of the Serenity Prayer.
That's precisely what I was thinking
yeah.
about.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Questions are invited. Comments also invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I want to thank the listener for her question and comment this afternoon. Well, how you describe counterfactual thinking is in terms of thinking it can be helpful to think of it as a benchmark for reality. And I'm wondering, could we function without counterfactual thoughts?
That's a wonderful question, and also deliciously ironic. What would life be like without counterfactuals? It's an interesting question to pose. And several theorists have suggested that it would be exceedingly difficult. And in fact, I'm thinking about a very famous book by a man named Douglas Hofstadter. He wrote a book in it's 1979, called Gödel, Escherbach, An Eternal Golden Braid. And it was a book about computer science, artificial intelligence, and art and thought. And he wrote one of the earliest descriptions of counterfactual thinking. He made the argument that if we're going to make artificial intelligence, if we're going to try and make smart machines, computers that can think and understand the world as it actually is and do meaningful things, they need a capacity for counterfactual thinking. And what that boils down to is a capacity to look at an event and benchmark it against alternatives, to think about what is the probability that this event would happen versus others. To place an event into context is to see where it sits compared to a lot of other things that might happen. And what we seem to see is that our own brains are doing this constantly without our realizing it, on a very automatic level. So you look around the street where you live or a street where you're walking, and you might see cars rushing by or storefronts. Without necessarily having these thoughts in mind, you will have a collection of information activated in your brain that are reflections of past experiences and that offer a silent comparison or benchmark against what you're actually seeing. And so when things are inconsistent with your past understanding, all of a sudden they stand out to you as surprises, as something inconsistent, as something weird. So you see a storefront that's got the lettering upside down. You see a car that's driving backwards. Mm. All these things are instantly available and obvious to you, in part because there's a silent running commentary of benchmarks that are automatically activated.
Yeah, it's kind of a what's wrong with this picture.
We're very good at doing that. We're very good at picking out individual things out of a wider context. And counterfactual thinking is just part of that.
Yeah. Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Eureka on line 4. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. First of all, thank you for the topic. Extremely interesting, and I think what you're saying is exactly the right thing to do as a result of regret. I guess my two questions, you have dwelt on them a little bit. I wonder if I could get maybe a bit more exactness. How would you advise people in the sort of the kicking themselves process, what practical steps? And I guess I think immediately of rational motive therapy and things like self-talk from psychologists like Burns and Beck. And the other thing is, and I think you are exactly right on about you need to let go again. I guess in my mind I say right thing to do, in reality easier to say than to do.
Yes, well, thanks for the comments. And you're exactly right about sometimes it's easier said than done. When I offer several bits of practical suggestions in the book, one of the lines of work that I think is most interesting is a set of studies that focused on the thought processes of entrepreneurs. And so these are people who take a lot of big risks, put a lot of money on the line trying to forge new business enterprises. And these sets of studies actually looked at counterfactual thinking and emotionality in entrepreneurs. And an interesting pattern developed, and it's a pattern that you might think of as an ideal that we might try to emulate. Again, it's easier said than done, but the pattern is this. These are sorts of people who feel regret deeply, very intensely. They kick themselves extraordinarily hard. And so it's almost like they're just reveling in the regret, but only for a very short period of time. And then just like that, they're moving on again. They're channeling the regret into new action and moving forward, sometimes in a very different direction. But the idea is to simply listen to the regret and then push yourself to new action right away. There's another interesting insight from basic research in social psychology, which reflects a common argument that people have. Do we regret more the things we do or the things we didn't do? Mm. Well, it actually depends on time. In the short term, we regret the things we do. But over the long term, the things that haunt us most over long periods of time are the things we didn't do, the things we left undone, the opportunities that were left unmet. And so one little bit of advice there is, well, if those are the things that you're most likely to regret, you should just do more, hesitate less, jump into things, and just push yourself into new situations more readily.
Yeah, I guess it's a way, too, of making decisions on what you're going to tackle and what you're going to forget about. It's inconsequential, or, you know, this is more important. As you said earlier when we were talking with the woman who raised the issue about the words, if only in a hospice situation, you know, there are going to be some things that you just, there's nothing that can be done. On the other hand, maybe you can mend a bridge, you know, that kind of thing.
Yes, very much so. And once again, there's this idea that our brains are very good at rationalizing. And there's a word that I use that is commonly used by psychologists today, the idea of a psychological immune system. Like our body's immune system, it's a system that's constantly vigilant against infection or foreign invaders. But it focuses on emotionality. It focuses on trying to eliminate thoughts that are psychologically dangerous. But it only gets activated under circumstances. It seems like when we act, when we do something deliberate, the psychological immune system is more readily brought to bear, and it shuts down regret faster. When we fail to act, or in any circumstance where there seems to be more open opportunities available, more options available, the psychological immune system is not so active. That's where regrets are biggest, but it's also where you have the most opportunity for action. So it's just a good general bit of advice just to blast ahead and try new things.
Yeah. What do we regret most?
Oh, well, that's a very interesting question. One that a variety of researchers have asked, and one of the things that I have been working on recently and appears in the book is an attempt to combine all these research findings into one big grand list of what we regret most in life. And the answers are somewhat surprising. The number one regret of Americans is education. People wish they had stayed in school longer, or more often they wish they had studied harder, they wish they'd applied themselves more, they wish they'd studied something different. A lot of times, if you think about what your biggest regrets in life, people will speculate that it might be perhaps matters closer to the heart, perhaps love or romance. That actually came further down the list at number three. Career was number two, so people were focusing on their true calling in life. What should I have done in terms of my work? And parenting or close family kinds of relationships, parenting especially, was number four. And I think what the list is interesting. I go up to 12 different life regrets, different areas of life, and I provide numbers in terms of how frequently they come up. By a large margin, education is the biggest area of regret for Americans. So it's interesting. Why might that be? Yeah. There's probably a number of reasons, and not just any one single reason. But one reason is certainly that it's a gateway to so many other parts of our lives in society today. So more education usually means more money, so you can do other things in life. Maybe it might mean a more satisfying career, or it might mean a more challenging career that falls into your own interests. It might also be more of an opportunity to meet other people. So education is a gateway to a lot of other aspects of life. It holds the key to where you end up in a lot of cases.
One other thing I was just going to say is
I've been emphasizing the idea of opportunity and regret persisting where we see opportunity most. It's interesting, in the last, say, 20 to 30 years, education has been something open to more and more Americans. Say, 100 years ago, it was the realm of the very privileged. Not everybody could even get to high school. Today, pretty much anybody from all walks of life and from all ages has a chance to go back and take some kind of course, do something new in terms of learning.
So I wonder if that regret will change over time.
Well, as educational opportunities increase in this country, I would predict that the regret centering on it would also increase. Any place in life where we see more choice and opportunity, we're going to see more regret. Another example of that might be whom we marry. It wasn't always so easy to move around the country and find a particular person. In some countries, in some societies, marriages are arranged. I don't think anybody's ever looked at this, but I would predict that people are more satisfied in places where there's less choice in whom they marry.
Well, you do hear these wonderful stories about people who've had arranged marriages, and their marriages have been wonderful.
Yeah, I haven't seen anything systematic in terms of a study of it, but another example I've heard recently is this thing called a covenant marriage, which is basically a set of legal prescriptions that make divorce much more difficult. So people who are getting married by way of a covenant marriage are much more stuck with each other than is typically the case. Now, will that be a prescription for more satisfaction later? I don't know. But I would predict, based on basic research in social psychology, that, yes, those people might actually be more satisfied because it's harder to get out of it.
You're stuck.
They're stuck. So they make the best of it.
Right. Are there differences? Can you tell us anything about differences that might be culture to culture? European, American, Asian, African, Latin?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question that has only just been studied by researchers. Up until, let's say, the last 10 years, most of the basic research in social psychology or in psychology in general has been very much bound to North America or European civilizations. And so it's only been relatively recently that people have taken the time and effort to compare basic thought processes in different parts of the world for people in different walks of life. There's probably two interesting things we can say about regret and counterfactual thinking. One is that as a basic experience of life, it seems to be universal. So no matter where we have looked around the world, people feel regret. Okay, they have these basic emotions that are like a universal language of humanity. Also, people around the world are able to focus on different parts of their life and imagine, just engage in this cognitive task of seeing how the world could have been different. People can do that in terms of a basic reasoning or logical ability. Now, the next question is, how often do they do it? And that's a different question. So people have the capacity or ability to do these things, but they don't necessarily all do it at the same level or frequency. So there has been some recent research that has looked at differences in belief in fate across cultures. For example, North America versus India. So in India, you might see more beliefs in different kinds of fate, which might seem to block or thwart the capacity to see how the past could have been different. I mean, if the whole of your life was fated to occur, it was just meant to be, then you'd think that you would never see how your own personal choice would matter or how things could have been different. It turns out that even people in India who subscribe to these beliefs in fate, and even Americans who believe in fate, still see a place for personal action and do still see a place for alternatives for regret. So overall, we see a remarkable similarity in the thinking patterns across cultures.
Is counterfactual thinking something of interest to political scientists?
Yes, it is. Although there is a debate, a very interesting debate among current theorists in political science. On the one hand, there's a view that counterfactuals are inherently fantasy. So if I think about what if President Kennedy, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, had listened to his hawkish advisors and bombed Cuba, what would have happened next? Well, the Soviet Union might have started World War III and the whole planet would be incinerated. Historians and political scientists have debated this. There is evidence that this of the likelihood of this occurrence. But some theorists will say, well, we can never know. I mean, it's all fantasy. It's all speculation. Other theorists will say, well, if we can generate documents or evidence that shows, well, this is what Premier Khrushchev would have done and this is what the generals would have done in response, then we can make these arguments very forcefully. The debate has raged back and forth, but it really is one that depends on how you view causation. And any time you talk about a counterfactual, you're talking about what things cause other things. So is it the case that Kennedy's decisions were crucial for the outcome of the Cuban Missile Crisis? Well, then you'll say he could have decided otherwise, and then things would have turned out differently. And so any time you talk about history, you're going to be talking about causes. Which forces led to other forces? Which events flowed into other events? Anytime you talk about cause, you almost by definition have to be talking about a counterfactual.
Yeah. What interests me, though, is the idea that counterfactual thinking, some knowledge of it, you know, the kinds of things that you're doing for lay readers in If Only, How to Turn Regret into Opportunity, could be useful for the diplomatic corps.
Possibly. There's been such an interesting series of recent studies that have examined the counterfactual thoughts of policy experts. And the studies have focused on the ideological divide of left versus right, conservatives versus liberals. And it's interesting, for example, to say, well, how did the Cold War end? How could it have been, you know, how did we nearly miss the end of the Cold War? And people of a particular ideological stripe will defend their views by a selective use of counterfactual thoughts. Mm. One particular study looked at hardline anti-Soviet experts who said, who were actually unable to predict the end of the Cold War. They, in the 1980s, they were saying, well, we'll be stuck with a Cold War for another 50 years. And then, surprise, it ends around 1990, 1991. But they defended themselves by saying, well, it almost didn't end because there was a coup in the summer of 91, and Gorbachev, the leader of the Soviet Union, was ousted, although the coup unraveled. But the hardliners in the Kremlin almost took over, and the Cold War almost continued on. And so they'll defend their point of view by pointing out these almosts of history that seem to validate their particular ideological view.
Could this research be of use to someone who's sitting down at a table to negotiate?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and I do talk about that in my book. Mm-hmm. There has been some recent research from some colleagues of mine at Northwestern focusing on how counterfactual thinking is an important part of negotiation. Anytime you sit down to negotiate, that means you're trying to get a good deal for yourself. You're interacting with another person who also wants to get a good deal. And one question is, how does one negotiation influence a subsequent independent negotiation? So if you had done something in the past, you didn't get a good deal, you're kicking yourself, oh, I should have tried harder, I could have gotten a better deal. How does that influence you the next time you go out? So more regret from the past can sometimes make people more conservative in the way in which they try to negotiate subsequently. But one of the interesting tips that's come out of this recent research is the idea that, as we talked about earlier, counterfactuals or alternatives set up benchmarks. And so how you evaluate what you have will depend on what you might have gotten. And so one interesting observation is that it's best to make the first offer in a negotiation. By making the first offer, you set the agenda. You set a price point or a number that everybody haggles around. The number will go up or can go down. But in an actual experimental test of this, people who set the first or made the first offer came out better after the negotiation was over. And so when people look back on it, they'll say, could I have done better? Could I have done worse? But it all really depends on the first offer that's made that's an anchor that everybody else haggles around.
Very interesting. Our guest this afternoon is Neil Rose. He's an associate professor of psychology at the University of Illinois. His area of particular interest in the field is counterfactual thinking and regret. Professor Rose is the author of If Only, How to Turn Regret into Opportunity. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, my name is Celeste Quinn, and I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon. We have about 8 minutes left here on this in this portion of the program. If you've got a question or a comment, give us a call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. We talked a little bit earlier, a little bit, about regret offering a window, an opportunity to take responsibility.
Yes.
What is the link between regret and responsibility? And maybe you could also talk a little bit about the link between regret and blame.
Yes. Well, they are intimately tied together. If we think about counterfactual thinking in its purest sense as a thought process we all engage in, there are two immediate offshoots. One is emotional, and we've talked a bit about that already, how comparing your current circumstances to something better versus worse that might have been can influence your current feelings of satisfaction, happiness, dejection, whatnot. So emotions are one class of effects. A second class of effects are causal inferences, causation, and that's what we were pretty much talking about a moment ago in terms of history and events that happened a long time ago. But in our personal lives, it's the exact same thing. If we want to express the idea that somebody can take responsibility for something done well, we can say, well, the project would not have been so successful without her contribution. So in other words, any time I say something about somebody taking responsibility for success, I can reframe it as a counterfactual. By the same token, I can blame somebody for failure. You know, I could say, if only so-and-so had pulled his weight, we would have been much more successful on this project. So counterfactual thoughts are intimately involved in our judgments of blame and responsibility. And this becomes particularly important when we move to a legal arena. If we think about how do jurors, for example, make judgments of guilt or innocence, Well, it turns out that our counterfactual thoughts are such a part of this that sometimes people can be biased in their blame of others by way of counterfactual thoughts that don't actually matter much in the situation. One particularly vivid example was a study done several years ago which looked at blame judgments for of mock jurors who are evaluating a case of a burglary. The burglary occurred while a family is on vacation, and there was two conditions, two different situations that were given to two different people, and this is the basis of the comparison in the experiment. Some people learned that the burglary took place in the middle of their vacation. Other people learned that it took place just before they were about to return. In that latter case, a counterfactual is much more vivid or salient. You think, well, if only they'd come back just a little bit earlier, they might have caught the burglar, you know, stopped the burglar in his tracks and recovered their goods and whatnot. Now, it turns out that that aspect of these situations that changed the salience or vividness of a counterfactual, of an if-only thought, influenced the judgments of guilt or innocence, also influenced people's judgments of how severe a prison sentence should be dealt out to the defendant. Now, if you step back and think about the legal aspects of this, you can say, well, the time period of the burglary really doesn't have anything to do with guilt or innocence. It's utterly irrelevant. Sometimes counterfactual thoughts tell us something useful about a situation that can be useful for a blame judgment, but this is an example of something that's utterly irrelevant. Counterfactual thinking, in this case, biases people's blame or responsibility judgments. And so it's a warning for everybody, not just jurors, but let's say consumers, to be aware of subtle influence attempts, let's say on the part of marketers or lawyers, where subtle counterfactual ideas are strategically inserted that make things like almost seem a bit more salient to you. And that subtly shifts your sense of blame or responsibility. And it makes you more biased. It makes things perhaps more unfair if you're not aware of it.
Very interesting. Let's talk with another listener, caller in Chicago, line 4. Go ahead.
Thank you. Your Cuban Missile Crisis analogy reminded me of a recent story by former Defense Secretary McNamara on the Charlie Rose Show regarding his latest book about one voice stood up against the hawks in a group that was assembled to respond to the Cuban situation. And his voice prevailed and took a softer approach rather than a hardline approach. Similarly, in the movie 12 Angry Men, Henry Fonda responded and stood up against all the others in the group, and his voice eventually prevailed. Similarly, in other cases in legal systems. But then the irony today is that we've gone through an awful lot of trouble to get into the situation we're in. And in terms of education, if we'd only known more, which means intelligence, and learned of the cultures and reasons for the people living the way they are, and maybe we could have traded places and begun to appreciate each other's cultures and learn to benefit from each other's ways much better. Thank you very much.
Yes, well, there's a number of interesting ideas there. It certainly goes to show that thoughts of if only and alternative possibilities are everywhere, and they're partly a function of what we know versus what we don't know. The reference is made to intelligence gathering, what we currently know about the war in Iraq, for example. Well, there's a lot of things we don't know, and they'll come out later in the case of the Cuban Missile Crisis. There's a lot of stuff we didn't know way back then. But people like McNamara, who have been writing books and talking about it, have revealed more and more. Documents from the former Soviet Union have been released, and we now know that we came much closer to nuclear war than we thought at the time. We came just that close to annihilating ourselves, and I think that's an important lesson. The closeness to an alternative bad outcome can be a wake-up call that can motivate us to positive change for the future.
Hmm. We have to wrap up here. Is there anything you'd like to close with?
I just wanted to remind people again that they can listen to the lessons of their own regrets. They are not things to be stifled. Negative emotions serve an essential psychological purpose, and they all focus on the effectiveness of our daily behavior and our inherent capacity for growth, renewal, and betterment.
Thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Our guest this afternoon has been Neil Rose. He's an associate professor of psychology at the University of Illinois. He is the author of If Only, How to Turn Regret into Opportunity. The book is published by Broadway Books. It's 9 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Celeste. This afternoon, futures at the Board of Trade finished the day like this. The beans were down 4 cents in the deferreds. The nearby March contract was a penny and a quarter higher. The corn futures narrowly mixed to mostly lower today, down 0.75 cents in the March-December contract, down 0.75 cents as well. And in the wheat pit today, futures were down at 2 cents in the nearby March contract with a high of 330, a low at 326.5, and a settlement price there at $3.30 a bushel. They were off, too. Most of the trade saying, well, we're just taking a breather after a pretty good run up. $1.25 higher over the last, month or so in the bean pit. Settling back a couple cents doesn't seem to be that big a deal. And the bigger news, probably not in Chicago today and the prices, but from the WTO, as the World Trade Organization held up a ruling against U.S. cotton growers and all of the export enhancement and subsidy programs, farm programs, that they had been receiving over the past several years. That could have long-term ramifications for not only the cotton growers, but certainly all the rest of the crop producers in the U.S., including corn and soybean producers. We'll talk with Steve Pigg, who's the former president of the Illinois Corn Growers Association and now serves as the chair of the public policy team at the National Corn Growers Association out of St. Louis. He was at an auction today, but we caught up with him, and we'll speak with him in just a few minutes during the closing market report. From the corn pit today, March futures down 0.75 cents today at 209.5, a low at 207.25, and a settlement price at 209.5, down 0.75 cents. May futures at 218.25 high, the low there 216, and a settlement price at 218, and they were down 1 for the day. July corn now, 225.5 high, low at 223.25, settled at 225, a penny and a quarter lower. And September futures, 231.5 the high, the low at $2.29.5, and a settlement price for the September corn, 231. They were off 0.75 cents for the day. December contract now, 239.75, the high, the low at 237.5, a settlement price at 239.25, down 0.75 cents. And March in the corn, 246, the high, the low at 244, settlement price at $2.44.5, rather 45.5 cents for the March of 2006 corn. And they were off 0.5 cents for the day. March oats, 175 settlement price with a high of 175.5 and a low at 174 for the day. May oats, a 156 settlement unchanged. From the soy complex, nearby March, $6.21 the high, the low at 608, settled at $6.20. They were up a penny and a quarter today. May futures, 628 the high, the low at 616.5. Settled 627.25, unchanged. In July soybeans, 631 the high, the low at 621. Settlement price there at 630 even, down 2.25 for the July soybeans. August futures, 629 the high, the low at 621.5. Settled at 629, they were down 2.5. In September, 621 the high, the low at 612. Settled $6.20, down 4 cents. November futures down 4.25, a 6.21 high, low at 6.12. Settlement price at 6.19.75. March bean meal, 187 the high, the low at 183.50. Settled at 186.90. They were up 70 cents on the day. And May futures at 188.70 high, low at 185.20 a ton. Settled at 188.40. They were down 20 cents. March bean oil, $22.93 the high, the low at $22.47, settled $22.85 off 15 cents. And the May bean oil off 14 with a settlement price at $22.97 and the high of $23.06. The low there for the May bean oil at $22.62. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Chicago Board of Trade, or rather from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. Celeste?
Thank you, Todd. It was a higher day today for livestock prices. March feeder cattle, the high today, 102.70, the low 101.25. The settlement, 102.62.5, that up 2.30. April, 101.60, the high, $100.70, the low price. The settlement, 101.50, that up 227.5. May, $100.30, the high, $99.20, the low, $100.10, the settlement, that up 177.5. April live cattle, the high 88.77 and a half, the low 87.60, the settlement 88.70, that up 190. June live cattle, 84.37 and a half, the high 83.55, the low 84.35, the settlement, that up 142 and a half. April lean hog, 76.60, the high 75.55, the low, the settlement 76.10, that up 145. May lean hog, 78.45, the high 77.50, the low 78.30, the settlement, that up 125. June, the high 81.60, the low 80.55, the settlement 81.55, that up 155. July lean hog, 77.85, the high 77, even the low, the settlement 77.80, that up 132 and a half. March bellies finished lower today, the high 90.90, the settlement 88.70, the low today 88.55. Let me give you those numbers again. The high for March bellies, 90.90, the low 88.55, the settlement 88.70, that down 65. The Dow up 25 points at 10,837. The NASDAQ off 6 at 2061. The S&P 500 up 1 at 1211.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM, working with the American farmer, creating products from his crops, creating markets for his crops. ADM, resourceful by nature.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Brittany Chambers from Chicago, Illinois writes, Dear Dr. Science, why are earthworms sensitive to light?
There are certain antibiotics that are naturally photosensitive. These are often fed to worms in order to make them suitable as a film emulsion. The worms are then pureed and spread onto a celluloid strip. Lower grades of worms are used for black and white film, but brightly colored tropical worms, especially intestinal parasites, well, those are used for color film. Some researchers fear that this misuse of antibiotics is causing antibiotic resistance. I like to think the snapshots are usually worth the risk. Plus, I expect the new digital cameras will reduce this use of antibiotics and possibly save mankind.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath and distributed by PRI. For information online about the Duck's Breath 30th Anniversary live show on DVD, go to drscience.com.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Warden Martin Subaru, a Subaru Stellar Performer certified dealership, now in their new location in front of the Savoy 16 Theater, across from Warden Martin Nissan. Information on the web at wardenmartin.subaru.com.
1 minute before 2 o'clock Central Time, 36 degrees in Urbana. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. Jason Croft is our technical director today.